The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Bring it on! The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. Today, pharmacist and blogger Scott Gavura returns to the show, this time to discuss the evidence-based perspective on vitamins. Which ones are beneficial? Which ones are bunk? And how is this billion-dollar industry regulated? And I'd like to welcome CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick, to our ever-growing army of science-friendly radio stations. You can find the link to CHMA, as well as links to all of our other fantastic rebroadcasters, at skepticallyspeaking.com. Just click media for the full list. And now, for Speaking Up. We're here with Stephen Worley, engineering professor at Purdue University, to talk about the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Stephen.
All right, thank you.
So tell us about what exactly happened to cause the spill in the first place.
Well, what happened was a blowout. What happens in a blowout is a huge gas bubble comes charging up the riser tube from the seafloor to the drilling platform and caused this explosion and ultimately fire and sinking of the Deepwater Horizons and so forth.
Now, you came to my attention because you had been mentioned in an ABC piece about the spill. You checked British Petroleum's numbers, and you say that the actual volume of oil being released is about 20 times larger than BP claims. Is that right?
That's correct. Now, I guess one thing to straighten out on that front is what I calculate is the total volume of fluid that's coming out of the end of the pipe. That's oil plus gas. So at seafloor conditions, you see this cloud of black stuff coming out of the end of the riser pipe. Somewhere between 30 and 50% of that is actually oil, and the rest will come out of solution as that liquid rises towards the surface. So 70,000 barrels per day is what I calculated, but you would take something like 30 to 50% of that to figure out how much oil is actually there.
What were BP's estimates?
They said 5,000 barrels per day, and that's a total oil number. So, I mean, you're right. So that's considerably different.
So why were you initially suspicious of their numbers?
Actually, I wasn't. I was basically a bystander watching the headlines of this accident in action. And I was contacted by a national public radio reporter in the U.S., Richard Harris. And he asked me, on the day that the BP released the first video, he asked me, contacted me and asked me if I could calculate how much oil is coming out of the end of that pipe. And that happens to be my background, is calculating, measuring flows. So I said I could, and that's the start of this whole thing.
Well, how did you arrive at the number?
It's relatively simple to explain, but naturally more complicated in execution. The process that I use is simply image analysis. If the listeners recall, on May 13th or May 12th, BP released the first video to the public that showed the oil coming out of the end of the riser pipe, the broken off riser pipe. And that's what BP called the main leak. And so Richard Harris of NPR contacted me and asked me if it's possible to measure that flow coming out of the end of the pipe. So that's, you know, that's basically what I've been doing for about 20 years now. Using this process, this image analysis process, I take the movie apart into individual pictures. And then it's like a flip book. You can compare one picture to the next and see how it's changed. And the listeners can do this, certainly. If you play any of the BP videos in slow motion, you can watch them from frame to frame. You'll see little structures. In the fluid mechanics business, we call them coherent structures. You see them step from one location to the next as you go from frame to frame. And essentially, I just track how fast those move, and that's approximately the average speed of the jet. And then I multiply that by the cross-sectional area of the pipe, and that gives me a volume flow. That's it in a nutshell.
So you say anyone can do this, but BP wildly underestimated the amount of oil that's being released.
That's right. I testified before Congress the week after I released these numbers for my calculations. And I was able to explain it to, you know, a room full of congressmen how to do this. You know, it isn't very hard. I mean, I do have advanced computer algorithms that make it more quantitative and more accurate than what I've just described. But basically, it's not that hard. And somewhere in BP's management team, they have to have somebody who knows how to do this, I would think. So I'm not sure why they didn't do it.
I find that interesting. Could they really just not have known how to do this calculation?
I don't want to try to characterize why they did what they did. Where I'd like to stop with this is in saying that it's a relatively common technique for measuring flows. And, you know, given the amount of engineering expertise they have working on this, somebody should have known how to do this.
So the big question is now how to stop it. So what's been attempted so far?
Well, it goes way back. The first thing that they attempted was there's this five-story structure sitting on the floor of the Gulf of Mexico called the blowout preventer, which is the structure that malfunctioned, I guess, back in late April, you know, when the blowout initially occurred. And the first attempt was to send down some of these remote operated vehicles, these remote control submarines, and try to manually initiate the valves that were supposed to have closed to prevent the blowout. And the blowout preventer was seriously damaged during the blowout, so that didn't work. And then after that, they made this, what I thought relatively quickly, you know, they had this containment dome built. I forget the numbers they said. So four-story structure, I mean, huge thing. And the idea was to lower this containment dome on top of the leak and catch all of the oil and funnel it to a pipe that would lead to a vessel on the surface where it would be captured. And what happens when the oil meets the seawater? It's actually very warm in the reservoir, you know, in the hundreds of degrees. When that oil surges out into the seawater is very cold. It's nearly freezing. And that's the freezing temperature of seawater. When the oil comes out of the end of the riser pipe, it has in it, one of its main components is methane. And the methane and the seawater combine and form hydrates. And these hydrates have a higher freezing temperature. So they immediately form ice. And this ice accumulated in the containment dome and ultimately floated it off of the bottom of the ocean. So that didn't work. And well, now we're on to the RITT tool, the riser insertion tube tool. That was the next thing they tried. That was the small, I don't know, I like to think of it as a drinking straw that they inserted into the end.
And right.
Scooped up a small amount of the flow. You know, eventually BP was capturing 8,000 barrels a day with that tool. So certainly the 5,000 barrel a day number that they had been reporting is wrong because they were still leaking oil outside of that RITT. So, and now we're on to the last, probably what's going to be the last attempt prior to the relief wells. And that's the cap that's being put on top of the blowout preventer. So today, BP severed this riser pipe, which was in very bad condition. Basically, they just cut it off of the top of the blowout preventer, and now they're putting a cap onto that. And the idea is that this cap will catch some to most of the oil that comes out of the well and funnel it up to a surface ship. The jury's out on how well that's going to work yet.
So if that doesn't work, is there another step?
I haven't heard another step from the BP PR people, and I'm sort of on the outside here. I'm a member of a U.S. government team to calculate the flow rate, and so I have access to a large amount of information related to calculating the flow rate of the oil, but I have almost no involvement with planning of any operations. So I guess the only way that I know of upcoming operations is when BP releases a press release.
Right.
So I haven't seen anything beyond this step, this latest capping effort.
BP now has a suggestion box on their website, and they're inviting the public to share their ideas. So as an engineer, thoughts?
I've heard from lots of people. I've been in front of the media regarding the measurements of the oil flow for about the last 3 weeks. And so I've heard from lots of people that they've submitted suggestions and haven't heard back from BP on those suggestions. Don't have any good suggestions myself, unfortunately, but
maybe better planning next time.
Well, that's entirely the issue here is actually, and I shouldn't point the finger strictly at BP here. They just happen to be the ones who are involved in this incident, but the petroleum industry is very good at getting oil out of hard to reach places, but they haven't been prepared for a blowout like this on the seafloor, you know, underneath a mile of water. They're just unprepared to deal with that. And things like the floating containment dome demonstrate that.
Thanks very much for being here, Stephen. Since we spoke to Stephen on June 3rd, BP has installed a containment cap called the Lower Marine Riser Package over the broken pipe. The company says that they're using it to siphon off between 10 and 15,000 barrels of the leaking oil each day, which is about half of what the U.S. government estimates is being released. In total, they say that they've used it to divert about 73,000 barrels of oil and 31 million cubic feet of natural gas. Of course, they're also warning that this type of containment equipment has never been used to that depth, so they can't guarantee its efficiency. BP is planning to use equipment that they installed for the failed Top Kill operation to supplement the system, and they expect to have that ready by mid-June. A larger, more permanent cap is being readied for deployment in July. Meanwhile, the U.S. Geological Survey is warning that tides and wave conditions could cause surface oil to flow over some barrier islands and into the bays and inlets on the coast. So, all in all, the situation has improved slightly, from being pretty much catastrophic to only whatever one step below that is. And I have with me now Ethan Clow, the executive director of the Center for Inquiry Vancouver and host of Radio Freethinker. Welcome, Ethan.
Hey, Desiree. Thanks for having me.
So you have an event that you'd like to tell us about.
That's right. We have a big event coming up on July 3rd. I'm very, very proud to announce that CFI Vancouver is hosting a talk by world-renowned astrophysicist Lawrence Krauss. He's giving a talk called A Universe from Nothing, and it's happening at UBC Woodward Building, room number 2 at 7 o'clock, and afterwards there's going to be a reception, so I encourage people to stop by for that. Lawrence Krauss, as many of you might know, is the author of over 300 scientific papers and articles, and was a science advisor on the TV show Star Trek, after which he wrote the bestseller, The Physics of Star Trek. So it's going to be an ultimate nerd center for physics, Star Trek, and the beginning of the universe.
This is definitely an event for skeptics and nerds of all types. So when and where is it?
So it's July 3rd, 7 p.m., UBC Woodward Building, room 2. You can purchase tickets online at our webpage. You can find that on www.cficanada.ca/Vancouver. I would remind everyone that CFI members do get free admission, so consider signing up as a friend of the center and support this great organization that brings you great speakers like Lawrence Krauss.
That was beautiful.
I know.
Thanks for being here, Ethan.
Thanks, Desiree.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. You can email your questions for next week's episode to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, we're at Skeptical Radio, or use our handy question submission box on the website at skepticallyspeaking.com. After the show, continue the conversation in the comments section of the website, or check out our Facebook group. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and while you're there, why not add a review of the show? Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of wonderful radio stations. Check the media page at skepticallyspeaking.com to see if we air near you. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. We're speaking today with show favorite Scott Gavura. In addition to being a pharmacist working in the Ontario Cancer System, he's the creator of the blog ScienceBasedPharmacy.com. He's also a contributor to the pan-Canadian blog collective SkepticNorth.com, and he recently started writing for ScienceBasedMedicine.org, which takes an in-depth look at the real science behind popular health claims. Welcome back to the show, Scott.
Hi, Desiree. It's great to be here again.
So when you and I spoke about doing this show, I thought I had a fairly clear idea as to why people take vitamins, but I was wrong. It seems like the reasons do fall into two categories. I don't want to get sick, or I'm already sick and I'd like not to be sick anymore. Is that accurate?
I think that's a pretty accurate description of the two categories. You could call them primary prevention, which is you're taking them because you don't want to be ill, and then the targeted supplementation, which is taking a specific vitamin or supplement because you want to eliminate a particular symptom or illness. And so the targeted supplementation is usually specific to a particular vitamin. Generally, the primary prevention is either multivitamins or sometimes specific vitamins as well.
So are there other reasons why people would take vitamins?
I think the traditional thought has been that people would take vitamins just for insurance, you know, just to balance out. If there's a, I don't have a good diet, I probably need to take a multivitamin. But I think that's being questioned now. We've moved from an era of these frank deficiencies like scurvy and rickets in rich countries like Canada and the USA to the state where, in general, deficiencies are rare. But I think as well, our science evolves, our science gives us more information. I think our knowledge of what the different vitamins and minerals do is evolving and growing as well.
I actually know people who have gotten scurvy. They were members of frats.
That's unbelievable.
But like you say, there are people with vitamin deficiencies, though.
Yes. Yeah, there are vitamin deficiencies, and they're not uncommon. Among the different vitamins, vitamin D is probably the most common deficiency. And there's good evidence to show that most Canadians and Americans probably don't get enough vitamin D. And the currently recommended levels, or the recommended levels that have been recommended for some time, may be inadequate. Now, if we look worldwide, vitamin A deficiency is very real. And vitamin A deficiency blinds between 250 and 500,000 children per year. So it's an astonishing deficiency in terms of vitamins. Now, in pregnancy, iron deficiency isn't uncommon. In Canada, it's about 1 in 5 women gets iron deficiency anemia. And then in people who have particular dietary habits like vegetarians, B12 deficiency is possible, sometimes B2. So there are chances for people to become deficient, but in general, it's much less common than it would have been in the past.
Well, how many people do you think they have vitamin deficiencies versus how many people actually have a vitamin deficiency?
Hard to give specific answers about that. In general, we know that in the U.S., and I imagine this applies in Canada as well, about 50%, over 50% of the population takes some sort of a supplement. But there's an interesting study in the U.S. that showed that children who take multivitamins are the least likely to need them. So that is, they're healthier, they exercise, they come from middle to upper income families. And those who use the vitamins the least are at the greatest risk of nutritional deficits. And poverty is the overriding factor.
We're speaking with Scott Gavura, pharmacist and blogger, about vitamins. If you have a question, email live at skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet Skeptical Radio. So does eating a healthy, balanced diet solve most of these issues?
I think in most cases, yes. I mean, vitamin D may be an exception because our exposure to that is both dietary and by the sun. But greater consumption of vegetables and fruits has been associated in the majority of clinical studies with lower risks of long, esophageal, stomach, and colon cancer. It's not known which compounds are providing the benefits, so the best advice is continue to eat real food. So the products like cruciferous vegetables, like the cabbage, kale, broccoli, they may be reducing the risk of colorectal cancer. We take a supplement based on an element within those products. We don't know for sure that we're actually getting the particular compound that is going to be providing us with the benefit. So I think in most cases, if you concentrate on diet first, you can eliminate most of the uncertainty around whether you're going to be getting the potential benefits. And in a lot of cases, it can be less expensive too.
Well, in regards to diet, is there any difference in vitamin content between eating organic foods and regular foods?
There have been some studies that have shown differences between organic and so-called conventional food, and they don't seem to be all that significant when you look in the context of your overall diet. So while you might find one particular product has more or less vitamins, if you're looking at it in the totality of everything that you're consuming, it doesn't seem to make a big difference. As long as you're eating a variety of foods, there's no evidence that it's going to be a significant factor in your nutrition or in the vitamins that you're getting if you're eating organic or not.
So when exactly is it better to get your vitamins in pill form then?
Well, I think that if you have an identified deficiency, then you need to make sure that you're actually getting that replaced. And in some cases, taking it as a pill form might be superior. And for example, vitamin D, if you have a vitamin deficiency, it's far safer for you to be taking vitamin D supplements as a pill than it is for you to go and expose yourself to UV radiation.
You've mentioned cost a couple of times. Is there any difference between the expensive vitamins and the cheaper versions?
No, generally not. There shouldn't be any difference in terms of what's in the particular product. There's a number of different companies that make products, and the products can range from fairly inexpensive all the way up to very, very expensive. And there's no evidence to demonstrate that the more expensive products are any better. Sometimes they're formulated slightly differently, but there's no evidence to suggest that they're actually superior.
How about natural vitamins versus synthetic ones?
In general, there is no difference between naturally formulated vitamins and synthetic, with one exception. Natural vitamin E is twice as potent as synthetic vitamin E. The reason is that when you synthesize vitamin E in a lab, it makes two mirror versions of the molecule, and our body can only utilize one, versus the natural vitamin E is just the version that our body can use. So you need to take twice as much of the synthetic to equal the natural. But with respect to other vitamins and minerals, there isn't any difference between the natural or the synthetic.
Well, how is that recommended daily dosage actually arrived at? Because higher milligrams don't necessarily mean better for you, do they?
Right. Well, there's a group called the Institute of Medicine, which summarizes the recommendations of Canadian and U.S. scientists. And what they start with is what's called the estimated average requirement, which is look at the scientific literature and say, well, what's the average amount needed to meet the needs of 50% of the population? So, because there's often a range. So we'll say, what do we think we need to meet the needs of 50% of each age group? So they'll come up with a value, and then they'll say, well, what should the recommended dietary allowance be? And often they'll take that estimated average requirement and then increase the amount by 20 to 30%, I believe, in general. And they'll say, well, this, if we increase it to this amount, it should meet the requirement of nearly all healthy individuals in each category. And then they'll further set what's called a tolerable upper limit. So the tolerable upper limit will tell us what's considered to be the safe range, where we know that we wouldn't expect to have any side effects. So between the recommended daily allowance, the RDA, and then the upper limit is the range in which we think we should be targeting in both either supplements or as part of our diet.
You mentioned before the show that there are challenges around researching vitamins.
I think to start, we need to ask, what are we studying? If we're studying kind of a common outcome, so let's say we want to study heart attacks or strokes. Well, those happen pretty frequently in the population. So we know that the effects of the vitamins will probably be subtle, and so we need to have huge populations in order to study them. And they usually have to be studied for several years. Now, this is done. So there's groups like the National Cancer Institute that are mounting these very large studies. I think in general is that we also need to try to separate, and this is why we need to do prospective control trials where we actually give one group a supplement and one group doesn't, gets a placebo, is to separate the correlation from the causality. Because in general, when we look at observational studies, people who take vitamins generally live healthier lifestyles overall. And so it's hard to decide, well, was it the vitamin that was doing this, or was it the fact that they exercise more and they're just wealthier and they have better access to healthcare? All these different determinants of health are often correlated with vitamin consumption. And that's why I said that the people who take the vitamins are the ones that in general don't need them. So there's Michael Pollan in his book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, says that we should be the type of person that takes supplements, which is interesting advice. So you want to be the type of person that takes supplements, but you don't actually need to take them. But you want to be of that type in terms of how you lead your life, if you're in a capacity to take them, but don't actually take them.
Right. You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we're discussing the science of vitamins with pharmacist and blogger Scott Guevara. Email live at skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. So let's talk about the specific research around vitamins. I had, honestly, I think more emails than we've ever received about a show in terms of questions. And people have some very specific questions in terms of the different vitamins. So I'm going to just shotgun these at you. And I'd like to know sort of what do people claim that these vitamins can do? What do they actually do? And if people should actually bother buying them at all?
Okay, I'll do what I can. I mean, I can give kind of general information, but often this needs to be considered in the context of, you know, patient-specific factors like your diet, you know, your lifestyle, are you pregnant, are you breastfeeding? All of these things often get factored in. So I'll try to give some general advice, and I can commit to giving you some links on the website to point people towards reputable sources to look up information.
Wonderful. Let's start with vitamin C.
So vitamin C, yes, vitamin C has been around a long time. This was the one that has been touted as everything from a cure for cancer to cure for the common cold. When I look at the list of what vitamin C can do, it's actually quite remarkable what is claimed. And actually, when you look at most vitamins in terms of what they're used for, the claims that accompany the vitamins is quite remarkable. So vitamin C is a water-soluble vitamin. Our bodies really don't need an awful lot of it in order to saturate our body's store. So it's water soluble, meaning if we don't use it when we take it in, our body will just flush it out. And that's why you'll sometimes see different slow release or timed release vitamin C, because that's basically, it just gets flushed out what we don't need. And we don't really actually need a whole lot in our diet. About 75 milligrams a day for women, maybe 95 milligrams for men. If you take more than 250 to 500 milligrams of vitamin C, everything else just gets flushed out. So if you take more than about 1,000 milligrams a day, you can get diarrhea. But in general, vitamin C is important. You pointed out scurvy, although I didn't think we saw a lot of that in Canada anymore, but clearly that's not the case. But
it's only in fraternities, I assume.
That's right. Most people shouldn't have a lot of trouble in terms of meeting that with even a rudimentary diet.
So then should people actually bother buying them?
Well, I guess if your teeth are falling out, maybe, but I think in general, probably not necessary. Most, like, fruits and vegetables have some vitamin C or juice. You know, juice is a good source of vitamin C as well. So any of those products have vitamin C, and it's not that difficult, I hope. But maybe I need to reevaluate my advice given your fraternity's anecdote.
How about vitamin D? Now, it seems like there are two main claims with vitamin D, that it helps with depression and that it prevents cancer.
I think vitamin D, as the vitamins go, is really pretty exciting because there's a lot of information showing that it may be providing, supplementation may provide a significant benefit in a number of different illnesses. And I hope it doesn't turn out like vitamin E, which was the golden vitamin for quite some time before its fall from grace with different types of data that have emerged to demonstrate that it really is not all that safe. But sticking with vitamin D, I mean, vitamin D is synthesized in our skin, and we can get a dose of a few thousand units simply by going in midday sun for about 5 or 10 minutes. So our body can make that, but in general, the population, Canadian population seems to be deficient, American population seems to be deficient too. So there's a lot of questions around how much we should be getting in our diet or overall. And what's really interesting is the level that we've always thought as being the normal level, is that the appropriate level? Because if normal is based on everyone else and everyone else is deficient, then maybe normal is actually low. So the best data comes from prospective trials, the randomized controlled trials where people are receiving either vitamin D or a placebo, and that's the best way we have to tease out correlation and causation. And there's a number of clinical trials going on that will help to give us quite a few answers in a number of different categories. The number of different foundations are currently, and groups are releasing new and updated guidelines for vitamin D. There is one that was just released from the Osteoporosis Foundation a couple of weeks ago, which has suggested that older adults need 800 to 1,000 units per day to get to normal levels. And it's interesting with osteoporosis. So vitamin D is thought to act on muscle tissue. So supplementation is thought to help support muscle performance. So reducing the risk of falls, which is good in the elderly, but it also seems to affect bone bone metabolism, and supplementation may actually help reduce the risk of bone loss in older women. And it's always been known that you need to get vitamin D with calcium, but I think that now there's a renewed focus on making sure vitamin D levels are appropriate. They're also looking at the role of vitamin D in for different types of cardiovascular disease. So it may be that patients who have low vitamin D are more likely to have high blood pressure, diabetes, type 1 or 2, heart failure, and different types of vascular inflammation. And there's some really good data emerging showing that if you're getting an adequate or a higher amount of vitamin D in your diet, then your risk of all-cause mortality, which is really dying for any reason at all, actually is lower if you've got more normal levels of vitamin D. So I think vitamin D is really promising. There's a lot of different illnesses that is being studied in, multiple sclerosis, another one. I don't think we're going to find that it's causal and that's the one true cause of disease. Certainly around the time of H1N1, as you recall, when we were there was a lot of pseudoscience that was going around online that was being touted. Vitamin D was being touted as a flu fighter, which I thought was interesting considering that H1N1 started in Mexico, right? There's a shortage of vitamin D.
Right.
That was kind of overlooked. But I think that there may be a relationship between susceptibility and response to influenza virus and vitamin D. And I don't think we have enough data to be absolutely certain, but I think there's reasonably good data to suggest that we probably need about 1,000 units from all sources in our diet to make sure that we're not low in vitamin D levels. So vitamin D, very, very interesting. We could go on for multiple shows on it, just in terms of all the different illnesses. So certainly very promising.
Well, what about sun lamps? Are sun lamps actually a good source of vitamin D?
Sun lamps are our source of vitamin D. Sun lamps are not a great source of vitamin D because they are a carcinogen in that they seem to be more harmful than actual natural sunlight in terms of your cancer risk. So while it is possible to get your vitamin D from sun lamps, vitamin D supplements are very inexpensive and they don't come with the carcinogenic risk of sun lamps. So my advice would always be to replace it through diet, even for people that are considering just regular sun exposure, not wearing sunblock versus vitamin D supplements. I would recommend, in this case, the supplements over sun exposure.
And we have a question from the chat.
From Nowu. Are there conditions that become more common at higher latitudes where there are fewer days people can synthesize D from sunlight?
Well, the amount of UV radiation varies based on both latitude and altitude. So it's certainly, I think, conceivable that the vitamin D absorption would be influenced by that. And as I said, I think that really the best approach with vitamin D is, one, to ask for your vitamin D level to be checked when you're doing a physical, and two, to take supplements if your vitamin D level is low. I think in general, most people probably should be taking a vitamin D supplement, except possibly in the summer, where more people are naturally going to be outside and will naturally get some inadvertent exposure to the sun.
So how about vitamin B? It's supposed to positively affect your immune system, or so the internet tells me.
So vitamin B, the B vitamins are usually packaged as a group. So there's B1, B2, B3, B6, B5, and B12, and then folic acid, B9. So they're generally packaged as a group. They're often called stress tabs, although there isn't any information to show that you either need more or they help with stress. And in general, the B vitamins and most multivitamins are harmless. Taking too much vitamin B6 can cause reversible neurological damage, though. So niacin is another B vitamin that actually works really well for treating high cholesterol and high lipids. Unfortunately, it comes with a side effect of this flushing in the face. So people will think, oh, I don't need to take my cholesterol medication. I'm just going to take natural niacin. But the side effect is really not that great. So there's some promise with niacin, but it is an effective medication. It's difficult to take, though. So the B vitamins are basically flushed out of your system when you if you don't take if your body doesn't use what you need. And if you take multivitamins and you notice your urine is bright yellow or orange, that's the riboflavin, the B2, which is coloring your urine. So anything your body doesn't use just gets flushed away. So some critics of multivitamins just say it creates expensive urine.
Right. So how about calcium? We know that that definitely contributes to bone health, but I have heard that there's a difference between the calcium that you chew and the calcium that you just take as a pill?
So I'm not aware of data that I've examined the chewable versus the pill. The absorption of the pill varies based on the different forms. So there's calcium carbonate, calcium citrate. Sometimes that can be influenced if you're taking medications like Losec or different types of medications to lower your stomach acid. So your choice of calcium product might vary. But I'm not aware of any difference between the chewable and the tablet. I think in general, you should take the form that you like because you have to take it for an awful long time to get the benefit from calcium, and you take it for, you know, really for decades. And if you prefer the chewable, then that's fine. But the important thing is to be taking the calcium regularly.
Now, vitamin E. Vitamin E, I think, is my favorite vitamin now because it apparently cures everything. It's claimed that taken orally, it helps with scars and acne, but also that it prevents muscular dystrophy, alleviates the symptoms of menopause, restless leg syndrome, and cures cancer.
Vitamin E used to be the golden boy or the golden girl of vitamins, and probably 20 years ago, everyone took it. It's an antioxidant. Antioxidants were going to save us from basically everything. You're right. There was some early data that looked promising, suggesting it might help us with heart disease, with stroke, with cancer. But as better data emerge, it's suggesting that vitamin E is either of no benefit or it actually could be risky. So the Women's Health Initiative study, which was the large one that looked at hormone replacement, had an arm that was looking at cardiovascular disease and showed no benefit in women taking vitamin E supplements 600 units a day. There was a Physician's Health study which also had no benefit. There was a large trial looking at vitamin E and selenium in prostate cancer, and actually that trial was halted early because possible increased risk of prostate cancer. Doesn't seem to be any benefit in preventing or treating Alzheimer's disease either. As part of a package of antioxidants in the treatment of macular degeneration, it does seem to provide some effect. If you take a multivitamin, there's no reason to take more than one that really contains more than 30 units of vitamin E. Up to 100 units is probably safe, but there isn't any proven rationale for taking large doses of vitamin E anymore. And in fact, most people are suggesting to avoid supplementation.
We have a question from the chat.
From Mystic99, what are the common results of vitamin overdose, and how common is it for people to overdose?
Well, I think it varies. As I pointed out earlier, when you're taking your multivitamins, or your vitamins as a multivitamin, which is usually as a single tablet a day, it's very difficult to overdose because the way that they're packaged, there's a small amount of all the different vitamins, and that's probably the safest approach to taking your vitamins. If you're taking individual vitamins separately, then the risk of overdose is real, probably of greater risk in the so-called fat-soluble vitamins. Those are the ones that your body can't excrete in the urine. So the vitamin E, potentially the vitamin A, where there are specific hazards to that, vitamin D. There was a incident in the United States a few months ago where a supplement advocate, spokesperson Gary Null, was poisoned by his own product because his own product was incorrectly manufactured with, instead of containing 2,000 units of vitamin D, I believe it contained 2 million units of vitamin D. And so I believe he ended up hospitalized with kidney problems from taking that much vitamin D of his own product. So, and the amazing thing is he's suing the company that makes his own product. It's a fascinating story from a number of different perspectives. I think from a regulatory perspective, it says a lot. I think it also illustrates to us that none of these products are innocuous. They all have some effect. And I think that our challenge is determining where are the beneficial effects and where do those beneficial effects drop off. And if I can jump back to the B vitamins, if you don't mind, Desiree, just to talk briefly about folic acid, because folic acid is one of the B vitamins, and I think that's one that's really fascinating as well as our evidence emerges around what we know about folic acid. And most women will recognize that folic acid has been shown, demonstrated to be effective in preventing neural tube defects. And so it needs to be taken prenatally because the neural tube forms often in your baby before you even know that you're, in some cases, before you know you're pregnant. So you need to have the folic acid levels normal in your body. And folic acid deficiencies were identified. And so folic acid was shown to reduce the risk of neural tube defects. And that's one of the reasons why our food supply is fortified. So our flour is fortified with folic acid. And so the breads we buy are fortified with folic acid. But taking a folic acid supplement is important too. So until this decade, the news of folic acid was all good. And so trials are starting to look at its use in things like cancer and heart attack and strokes. And what's really interesting is that now it seems to be possibly unsafe when used orally in large doses for long term. And it seems to be, when it's taken at higher doses for a few years, it seems to significantly increase the risk of developing cancer and adverse cardiovascular effects compared to placebo. So remember, it's fortified in food. You know, even if you don't take a supplement, you're getting a supplement. So there's no reason for anyone to take more than 400 micrograms a day. So it might be safe, but there's no evidence that we really need it. Women who want to become pregnant should be taking the supplement of folic acid. And it's kind of thought that folic acid may actually provide a stimulant effect to cancers that are already in our body, already growing. So it may actually kind of be feeding the cancer. So it's not clear that folic acid supplements are necessary in the vast majority of people.
Now, you've mentioned multivitamins a few times during the show. Are multivitamins something that people should be buying? Are they effective?
I guess it depends on what you mean by effective. I mean, I think that if you want to take a product that in general makes sure that you're getting kind of the recommended daily allowance of the, you know, of an array of different products, then that's probably fine. In a lot of cases, we've discussed, these products are water soluble, so whatever your body doesn't use, it just flushes out. There's often a small amount of iron, which is probably reasonable. You know, many people, especially premenopausal women, are deficient. We don't get enough magnesium in our diet. There's often a small amount of magnesium in there, so that's probably reasonable too. There's usually a small amount of vitamin D, not enough to meet our needs, but there's usually a small amount of vitamin D, small amount of calcium. So in general, that's probably fine. I think that what the concern is now is to say, well, what do we need to be taking everything that's in there? So should we be taking this just for insurance? And I think the case of folic acid is one that's cause for concern. So the folic acid is typically 400 micrograms or 0.4 milligrams in most multivitamins to reduce the risk of birth defects. But now there's questions about whether we should be taking that much if we're not of childbearing years, and particularly with males, if men need to be taking that much folic acid. It's difficult to say, and it really depends on a number of different factors. I think, as I said at the beginning, in general, I don't think we necessarily need to be taking multivitamins. If we put our efforts into making sure that we're trying to eat a diverse diet that's fairly balanced and has a variety of fruits and vegetables, we can meet the vast majority of our needs.
And is there a best time of day to take a multivitamin?
In general, I suggest people take the multivitamins with their largest meal of the day. Sometimes multivitamins can cause nausea, and taking it with food can help. And also, if we think about the multivitamins as being isolates from different parts of food, then there may be cofactors or other elements in the food that help us both absorb it and utilize those vitamins. So taking it with a large meal is probably the best bet, because then it'll be mixed up and dissolved with our food and absorbed at the same time, the nutrients.
You've mentioned regulation a few times. How exactly are vitamins regulated in Canada?
So in Canada, vitamins are regulated by the Natural Health Products Directorate. And the Natural Health Products Directorate is a part of Health Canada. So the standards are set by Health Canada in terms of manufacturing, labeling. In general, the Natural Health Products Directorate is perceived as being a fairly industry-friendly division, in that the regulatory standards are not the same as they are for prescription drugs. But it's Health Canada that establishes the standards in terms of how the products, like the manufacturing practices and the labeling standards. They approve labeling claims in some cases.
Do vitamins have the same kind of standards as pharmaceuticals do?
I think it'd be difficult to compare directly, and that would be getting a little bit out of my area of expertise in terms of the manufacturing area. But I think in general the intent is to have similar standards. But certainly when we look at the allowable claims, it's personally to me quite concerning. So if we look at selenium, which is another supplement, that there's concern that taking selenium long-term might not be safe. It may increase the risk of squamous cell skin cancer. It doesn't provide any protection against heart disease. You may be getting more diabetes from it. There was a huge trial, as I mentioned before, when we were talking about vitamin E, that looked at selenium and vitamin E, that was halted because of increased risk. And the selenium group was getting more diabetes. This was a study that was looking at prostate cancer. So this trial was started. So really, there's no rationale for taking a selenium supplement specifically on its own. The small amounts that are in multivitamins are probably safe, but there's no rationale to be taking a specific supplement. But despite the lack of evidence, if we look at Health Canada, Health Canada has approved selenium supplements with claims like helps support prostate health.
Right.
I think there's a disconnect there in terms of making sure that the claims that are approved by Health Canada are evidence-based and science-based and up-to-date.
And that's interesting to me because most people assume that if they take a vitamin, it's going to be good for them. And I don't think a lot of people would compare it to a pharmaceutical at all.
Well, I think that vitamins can behave as drugs. They can be therapeutic substances, absolutely. And I don't think we should be so casual in both accepting the benefit or on the risk. And I think we need to think carefully about when we're being reductionist and taking elements of food and taking large amounts would be very difficult for us to obtain when they're not in our diet and expect them to be all good and not have any possible potential negative effects. The challenge is it's very difficult to know about those negative effects unless they're actually prospectively studied. And in a lot of cases, we just don't have the study. And so health professionals like myself are generally very cautious about recommending things.
I was actually reading the Health Canada warnings from this year in preparation for this show. And one that I was reading was about an unauthorized product being marketed. And I'll read you this. It says, Health Canada raised issues about the bitter apricot kernel extract in the vitamin B17 products, which said it could release cyanide when ingested, and which could be lethal. So that leads me to a number of questions here. I've never heard of B17. Is that a real vitamin?
I don't think so.
Oh, okay, good. Do natural health stores often sell unauthorized vitamins?
It's difficult to answer. I mean, there certainly is an effort now, certainly within pharmacies. Pharmacies have been asked to not sell any unapproved natural health products. There's a huge backlog that Health Canada's been dealing with in terms of implementing the natural health product regulations. And the requirement is, and the expectation is, that all products that will be sold in Canada will be approved by Health Canada, which makes sense. But there is still a large backlog of products of which there's no approval yet. And so we need to, I would look as a consumer to look for either a drug identification number, it'll say DIN and there'll be a number on the front, or an NPN, which is a natural product number. And then you will know that the at a minimum, the product should contain in the bottle what's on the label and that basic safety issues have been ruled out. So you won't have any cyanide containing product, hopefully, in a Health Canada approved product.
And today on Skeptically Speaking, everything that you ever wanted to know about vitamins with pharmacist and science-based blogger Scott Gavura. We'll be right back with some listener questions right after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're joined by the cosmetics cop Paula Bigone. Paula is the best-selling author of The Beauty Bible and Don't Go to the Cosmetics Counter Without Me, and the creator of Paula's Choice brand of cosmetics. We'll examine the science and expose the hype behind some popular beauty products and find out what real research says about makeup myths. And on Speaking Up, we get a preview of The Amazing Meeting 8 with the James Randi Educational Foundation's Jeff Wagg and Austin Lutton, and K.O. Myers from Grassroots Skeptics. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 p.m. Mountain Time at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. Joining us today is Scott Gavura, pharmacist and blogger at sciencebasedpharmacy.com. So we have enough listener questions that we could actually probably do an entire episode of just listener questions, but we'll try to tackle as many as we can. This one is from the website submitted before the show.
I would be interested to learn about how complex molecules like vitamins survive the harsh environments of the digestive tract intact. Do we know if it even reaches the bloodstream without being metabolized? That's from Michael.
Great question. Well, when the vitamins are in their original sources, food, we do know that they are going to be absorbed and to reach our bloodstream because otherwise we wouldn't be getting any of them. I think that the question about whether when we're taking it as a vitamin, as a supplement, an isolated supplement, whether the behavior is the same is probably a fair question, and I think that's one that we don't have an answer for unless we actually prospectively study. Sometimes we can look at blood levels. Sometimes there's other proxies for measuring whether the product is getting absorbed. I think one of the ways to at least address that to some extent is to make sure that you're taking your multivitamin with food, which should help the absorption as well.
And we have another question from the website.
I've heard that some vitamins inhibit absorption of other vitamins or minerals. Is this true?
Yes, I can think of one example right off the top. There is zinc. If you take a lot of zinc, it can cause copper deficiency and anemia. So that's one. So and that's a great question as well, just suggesting that we really, it's difficult with when you're looking at isolated vitamins and particularly large supplements, that there can be implications in terms of the absorption on and how other products are absorbed and metabolized.
And another question.
What is the role of vitamins in my diet as a triathlete?
I think that's a great question. I have been a triathlete for several years, so I've grappled with the same question. And I've spoken to other triathletes about this, and one of the points that I like to make with triathletes is you're training a lot, you're exercising a lot. It's important to, when you're replacing all the calories that you're burning, replacing them with the absolute best quality food that you can, which is as much as possible whole foods and not processed foods, which will have, in general, less nutrition in them. I think that it's difficult to answer with certainty whether vitamin supplements are absolutely required as triathlete. One of the interesting areas that I've been, don't have a lot of knowledge about, but I kind of follow with a great deal of interest, is the role of antioxidants in for athletes and for those that exercise. And I guess the traditional thinking had been, you know, exercising increases free radicals. If we take antioxidants, it gets rid of those free radicals. So that's good, right? But what's interesting is now there's kind of some investigation into looking, well, do the antioxidants actually block the health promoting effects of exercise to some extent? It's very interesting data. It's not conclusive, but I think it certainly gives me cause for concern about whether you should be popping a lot of multivitamins after your exercise, if it may actually be compromising the full beneficial effects of the exercise itself.
And yet another listener question.
How do I encourage a vitamin user to eat more and better food? A colleague of mine, and fellow scientist I should say, is a slender fellow and is doing a lot of gym work to try and bulk up and gain weight. He daily takes a baggie full of all sorts of vitamins and supplements that he says are all natural. He says they even include carrots and cabbage in the ingredients. I asked him why he didn't just eat carrots and cabbage. Is there a nice way to encourage someone to not spend their money on high-priced pills instead of cheaper produce?
Wow, there's a lot of questions in there. Some of those, I think, Desiree, I'd have to refer to one of your guests who operates the Actually Speaking blog, who I think does a great job in setting aside the science and talking about the basic ways of interaction. I think I can give an answer from a science perspective in that I would, my approach would really be to talk about kind of the thinking or the why someone would be interested in taking the vitamins, and it could be that there could be a number of reasons. They might just not be able to get these products in their diet, and in some cases maybe referral to someone like a dietitian might be helpful, or there's different resources available even online in terms of tracking the diet and then identifying what could be, you know, what changes can be made. And sometimes it can be done for not a lot of money, and often supplements can be quite expensive as well, so there may not even be an additional financial cost to that. I think that's a difficult question to answer, so I hope that's helpful.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and today we're talking about vitamins with pharmacist Scott Gavura. And do remember that you can always submit questions prior to each week's show via the website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And another listener question.
I was wondering what you thought about fish oil supplementation. Not technically a vitamin, but if you could answer it, I'd appreciate it. I've heard tons of great things about it. Fat loss, reduced inflammation, cardiovascular health, the importance of omega-3 to omega-6 ratio. Is the science backing any of this up?
And I have to point out that I received quite a few questions on this topic.
I think fish oil is a topic unto itself. You could easily do an hour on that, and I'd love to come back, or you could get an expert who knows a lot more about this specific topic. But I think from a general perspective, the fish oil is very exciting, really interesting, and I think that there is really good evidence to show that fish oils can have very beneficial effects, particularly around cardiovascular disease. So the one area, again, that's always interesting to tease out, and a lot of the studies have looked at fish consumption and not necessarily fish oil consumption. So the challenge is to tease out the impact of the fish oil versus just the fact that you're eating fish and substituting eating something else like Big Mac.
And another question?
I had a baby 6.5 months ago, and I'm still nursing, as well as feeding a wide variety of solids. My OB advises me to continue taking a prenatal calcium and vitamin D. By the way, we live in Alaska where daylight is in short supply in the winter. A previous doctor had told me that vitamin supplements are not really necessary even during pregnancy because fortified bread products and a balanced diet provide adequate nutrition. So my question is, where can I go to find out which vitamins are necessary, if any, during pregnancy and nursing, and from my young child? And that's from Barbara Bundy in Anchorage.
Most women who are nursing generally it's suggested that they continue to take a multivitamin simply because of the iron and the calcium in that to help replace the nutrients that are being lost in the breast milk. As well, it's important to continue to give vitamin D while you're breastfeeding, because vitamin D doesn't appear in breast milk, particularly in Alaska, and if there isn't any other opportunity to get vitamin D. So I think that's kind of the general advice. I would refer the caller back to the family doctor for more specific advice, or maybe their pharmacist might be able to provide some customized advice as well.
Now we have sort of an extension of that question.
I know multivitamins in adults aren't worth it or are counterproductive, but what about children's multivitamins or infant drops? Is it insurance, a waste, or harmful? Steve from Ann Arbor.
I would say yes, it's insurance. I wouldn't necessarily say it's a waste. It's difficult to say that. I can reiterate that generally speaking, routine multivitamin supplements are not necessary in children. The American Academy of Pediatrics doesn't recommend routine vitamin supplementation in children.
And we are completely out of time, Scott. Thank you, as always, for being here. It's wonderful to have you here.
We had a lot of vitamins we didn't cover, so...
we'll have to do a part two, as in many of my shows.
Yeah, and I will commit to putting some links on the website for people who are interested in finding out more. I'm happy to do that.
Wonderful. And some of those links that are already on the website are links to Scott's prolific roster of blogs. You can go to sciencebasedpharmacy.com, sciencebasedmedicine.org, or skepticnorth.com. And you can find our site at skepticallyspeaking.com. There are links to Facebook, to Twitter, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to this show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on! The skeptics await your letter. You call Tweet, Homing, Pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking, online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
On Skeptically Speaking, we discuss a wide range of skeptical and science topics with a variety of experts. But I'd like to remind you that you, yes, you personally, are invited to join us on air every week for Speaking Up. Because let's face it, outreach is a part of skepticism. We all do it, whether we're talking to our parents about why they shouldn't buy into that multi-level marketing scheme, explaining the misinformation around vaccines to our coworkers, or forwarding that Snopes entry on why typing in your PIN number backward on the ATM machine does not, in fact, summon the police. But if you want to take your skeptical activism one step further and reach a broader audience, we're here for you. Do you have an event coming up that you'd like to promote? Or maybe you're a blogger that's been doing some great work and you'd like to talk about it? Or you'd just like to get some experience speaking publicly on a science or skeptical topic? What better way to get some real-world practice than on a friendly, rational radio show? If you're ready to have your say, do send an email to feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com. Put speaking up in the subject line, tell us a bit about what you'd like to discuss, and we'll contact you to set up your very own 10 to 15 minutes of on-air goodness. We're looking forward to hearing from you.